in some cases simply to phrases, I believe. Is that correct? Or sentences? That the Secretary General, at least, concluded that the sovereignty problem as the block to an ultimate settlement had been at least put aside. And this was your conclusion?
Yes.
You shared that. But very shortly after that, at least from the Secretary General's point of view, a very critical and seemingly hopeful point of negotiations, you were called back to London.
Yes. Well, what had really happened by then, this was about the 14th or 15th.
Right.
By that time, you see, we had actually elaborated, I can't remember, 13 or 14 articles in what would have been a treaty, an agreement. And the elaboration of all these articles had taken a lot of trouble, a lot of time, and a lot of pain. And God knows how many telegrams I'd sent off to London and how many I'd had back and how many amendments and counter-amendments there'd been and so on and so forth.
Could I just interrupt to ask a secondary question there? You found this method of negotiations, which were so-called proximity negotiations, useful.
Yes. I thought that it seemed to me we really were making progress. And it was quite obvious that there were severe problems. Never mind, maybe we'll come to which ones they were in substance. But there were severe problems. But we seemed to me, by around that weekend, as it were, when I flew home, we seemed to be pretty close to agreement on most of the important things. The principle of mutual withdrawal, the principle of an interim period of administration on the islands, the principle of a final set of parallel negotiations for a definitive solution, and so on and so forth. There were one or two points. We wanted to separate the notion of South Georgia, South Sandwich, from the Falklands, which seemed to us reasonable enough because the basis of the original plans was completely different. Argentina wanted them held both together. The question of the islanders and what happened to them during the interim period was also unresolved. But I suppose the momentum of negotiation, the modus operandi, which meant that article after article was kind of built up with a few square brackets, made me feel that we really were getting somewhere. At the same time, the whole business was becoming incredibly complicated because of the amendments and counter-amendments and all the rest of it. And so it was quite obvious to me that sooner or later I was going to have to go home and we were going to have to look at this round of table with our war cabinet, with the Prime Minister and all the rest of it. I can't remember who suggested that I should come home, whether it was me or London, doesn't matter. I mean, if London hadn't suggested it, I'd have suggested it myself. I remember that there was a kind of feeling in the opposite camp that this was some kind of device, or rather this was a sinister move on our part. On the contrary, it wasn't at all. It was really an attempt to really to produce a clean text. There was a feeling in London that we'd reached the end of progress by the means we'd been using, that we were beginning to go round in circles, that the whole thing had to be brought to a head fairly soon. There were practical reasons for this, too. The task force was approaching the islands. Obviously, it couldn't toss around in rough seas for 6 months. So something had to happen. I mean, either there was going to have to be a peaceful withdrawal or there was going to have to be military action. So we needed to bring it all to a head. So back I went, and Nico Henderson from Washington was summoned back as well, and we met up at Chequers in this very historic meeting with the War Cabinet.
And at that time, is that when the draft British interim agreement was prepared?
Yes, I mean, in effect, you see, this was based on the text that we prepared with the Secretary General that he'd initiated. When I got down to the meeting, the latest draft, as amended and re-amended and agreed and so on and so forth between me and London, was in front of us. And we went through it with the Prime Minister in the chair over a very, very protracted period, 5-6 hours. We went through it word by word, comma by comma, line by line, phrase by phrase, over and over again. And in fact, made fairly few, only very fairly few amendments to it. There was certainly insistence on what we might call a more democratic role for the islanders during the transitional period. That was a point on which we dwelt for a long time with Chapter 11 of the Charter in front of us. But what we agreed in the end was very close to what I'd brought home really from the Secretary General. And indeed, in essence, it was mutual withdrawal, a 6-month interim period, extendable, parallel negotiations, a UN administration with more or less equal status for Argentina and Britain alongside that administration for 6 months. I thought that it was a far more positive offer on our part than anything I'd ever expected to have agreed in London. I remember saying to the assembled meeting, you know, because we'd been through it in so much detail, line by line, I said, look, now, let's look at this as a whole, and I hope that everybody realizes exactly what the implications of this are if Argentina accepts it. And yes, this was agreed. And I think it was agreed at that time that whether or not Argentina accepted, that this would still be published to the House of Commons. So it was, there was no nonsense about it. And when I flew back the following morning on Concord, I think I had in my hands the only copy in existence of what the British government was prepared to agree, which I gave to President Peel the following morning, that one.
Was this this text, this agreement, from the British point of view, subject to further negotiation, or was it basically a take it or leave it?
It was basically a take it or leave it. There was a very strong feeling that, you know, there was nothing more to negotiate, that this was a very, very reasonable offer. And we set a 48-hour deadline on acceptance or rejection, not so much, again, as a kind of device or because we wanted to land troops or anything like that, because we really felt that everybody had had so much time, including the Hague mission and the Pereira mission, that there was absolutely no point in procrastinating any longer, that there it was as clear as a bell. And when I gave it to Pérez de Cuellar, if my memory serves me right, he was very positively impressed. He hadn't expected anything as positive as this to come back from London. Nor did he demur at all at the 48-hour deadline. He too appeared to think, I mean, I can't speak for him, but this was the impression I got from our meeting, appeared to think that this was perfectly reasonable and that this gave Argentina plenty of time to look at it, because after all they had themselves something which was very close to this text, because there weren't any major changes in London.
And there was one point in it that I think could be seen as a definite concession to the Argentine position, and that is the use of a reference in talking about the islanders to an earlier UN document, I think it's Resolution 2065, rather than speaking specifically of the wishes or the aspirations. The earlier document had referred to the interests, I think. This was intended, I assume, as an important...
Yes, I think this was intended in that sense. I mean, there was a discussion as to whether we should include any mention of these previous resolutions, but we decided to do so. I mean, it was a very serious effort. I mean, I don't say this in any propaganda sense. It was a very serious effort to get a peaceful resolution to the thing. We did discuss round the table what the chances were in London, in England, of Argentine acceptance. And I can remember saying that I didn't put it much higher than, say, 25-30%, because I rather doubted whether the Argentine government was in a position to get its act together in Buenos Aires. But I think I also remember expressing the view that they'd be after bloody fools if they didn't accept it.
One other thing was done with regard to this draft interim agreement. It was published very quickly. Why?
The sequence was, I handed it to Pérez de Cuellar on a Monday, and he got the Argentine reply on Wednesday evening. He telephoned me on the Wednesday evening and said that it was in Spanish and could I wait till the following morning. I said no, because I would miss a whole day with the 5-hour time gap. I had to have a summary that evening. So I went down at about 11 at night. He was alone with Alvaro de Soto, and Alvaro read out a summary translation, and I realized straight away that the Argentine reply didn't even address the proposals article by article. It does seem to me to be a lot of kind of negative rhetoric. I realized that it was a refusal. I remember saying to Pérez de Cuellar that he mustn't blame himself. I didn't think any man could have done more, but he and I both realized that as a result of this, that a lot of young men who were alive today were going to be dead in a week or two's time. And this filled me with regret. I reported accordingly to London. And then on the following day, Pérez de Cuellar decided to have a last attempt and talk to Galtieri on the telephone and also to Mrs. Thatcher. And he made two proposals to Mrs. Thatcher. I can't remember what they were in detail. And she took them on board, and I remember thinking at the time that they really didn't cause us very much difficulty. But Galtieri never responded to whatever was proposed to him by Pérez de Cuellar. And so then the Prime Minister did go ahead and publish the proposals to the House of Commons. I'm not entirely sure of her motives, but I think it was right. There was a great deal of speculation going on in Britain at the time. There was a great deal of worry in certain elements of the Conservative Party that, you know, the islanders were going to be sold down the river, and, you know, there was a lot of kind of secret diplomacy going on which people didn't understand about, and there was a certain amount of turbulence, I think, in the political arena in Britain, and I think she felt she must clear the air. I think it was a right move. As it was, of course, she came under very severe criticism from her right wing for having made such enormous concessions. I remember when I came home in July, I was asked straight away to address a large meeting of members of Parliament in one of the House of Commons committee rooms. And what with one thing and another, I rather expected to be greeted as a kind of hero. But not a bit of it. I got a very, very rough time indeed from Conservative MPs for allegedly kind of persuading the Prime Minister to, you know, sell out the islanders to Argentina in this particular negotiation.
The Secretary General then made a further effort and presented yet another aid memoir, remember, in which he spelled out what he thought had been agreed between
right.
the sides.
Mm.
And the issues which had not yet been agreed, and he made certain suggestions which I think were similar to those he had already mentioned.
Correct, with yes.
Mrs. Thatcher on the phone, as to how perhaps these could be overcome. What was your reaction then at this point? Was that, did you see this as an act of desperation on the part of the Secretary General?
I think I did. I mean, once I saw the Argentine reply on that Wednesday evening, I knew that the game was up, you know, that it wasn't going to fly. It was all over. I mean, if the reply had been close to the articles that had been put to them, and there had been room for more negotiation on, say, some minor details, or even one or two points of principle, fair enough, we could have gone on. But as it was, the reply didn't even address the draft text, article by article. I realized that it was so far off that it was irrecoverable. And even in spite of the Secretary-General's efforts, that the die was cast. It was going to have to be military action. We were bound to be back in the Security Council. And my job was, again, to fight our corner as best I could in the Security Council.
And any response which you might have, any instructions you might have received with regard to this May 19th aid memoir of the Secretary General were dependent on an Argentine response.
Exactly. I mean, the Prime Minister made it plain to me that, okay, we'd said this is our last word, but I can't remember whether she said this or I thought this. I mean, my judgment was that these points didn't give us all that much difficulty, but it was made clear to me that Argentina must reply first because they were so wide of the mark. And when they didn't reply, well, then events took their course.
So any, if I can ask this question, then any instructions you had at that point, in your view, would not have changed the situation?
No, they wouldn't. I mean, even if the Prime Minister had said, which he didn't, okay, we accept these 2 points that the Paris Declare had made, it wouldn't have made a damn of difference because Argentina was just playing in a different ballpark.
Yeah, I'd like to switch to the Argentine side now just a minute. And what was your assessment of the Argentine team, which was not just one team, but I think 2 teams?
Well, my assessment, I mean, Enrique Ross, whom I knew, of course, and liked and respected, I regarded him as very much the same kind of diplomat as myself. And I had no doubt that he was playing the hand skillfully and accurately from New York. I did not believe that he was getting the kind of well-ordered consideration in Buenos Aires for whatever views he was putting that I was getting from my government. And indeed, a very influential Argentine official told me 3 or 4 years later, who had been in Buenos Aires at the time, when I described to him my meeting with the War Cabinet on the 15th or whatever it was of May. I mean, he said, well, you should have seen the equivalent in Buenos Aires. It was unbelievable. So it wasn't a question of, I think, 1 or 2 teams. It was a question sometimes of about 10 different teams operating there. I mean, I got the impression very strongly that, you know, Enrique was playing it from New York just as I was playing it from New York, but he hadn't the faintest idea of what kind of reply he was going to get back, whereas I had a very shrewd idea what I was going to receive in return.
And there was no direct contact at that point with Costa Mendes, was there?
No, between me and him?
Yes.
No. I mean, I think one of the reasons was really, or between Enrique and myself, I mean, I would have been delighted to talk to Enrique or Costa Mendes, and I dare say they would have been quite happy to talk to me. But the curious thing about the whole Falklands crisis was this incredible public media interest which it aroused. I mean, I dare say the Gulf War probably overmatched it, but even real veterans of the United Nations like yourself were saying that they'd never seen anything like it in terms of media interest. So we really just didn't dare see each other because I was never unaccompanied. I was never on my own. I always had half a dozen television cameras and microphones and that kind of thing dogging my every footstep. And so, you know, that would have been a big deal if I'd even said good morning to an old friend like Enrique Ross.
Yes, well, Enrique Ross has indicated his view that if direct negotiations between you and him, or between the British and the Argentinian side, had been possible, that the prospects of agreement would have been better. That, in fact, the rather devious negotiating procedure followed, which the Secretary General had to follow, inhibited agreement rather than the contrary. What do you think of that?
Well, I think the only way in which I would agree with him is this. I've often felt since then, and particularly in the context of this Gulf War that we've just got over, or partially over, that the junta in Argentina, Galtieri and co., never actually believed that Britain meant business. Curious enough, a large number of my very experienced diplomatic colleagues didn't believe that we meant business.
They simply couldn't credit that, having obviously been trying to get off the hook of the Falklands for years, that we would re-impale ourselves on it, even though Argentina had extracted us in an extremely offensive way by invasion, that it would end up somehow with a lot of rhetoric and protests and so on, but not with military action. Rather, as I don't believe that Saddam Hussein ever really thought that the United States would actually liberate Kuwait by force and drive him off. I suppose it is possible that if there had been direct negotiations, say, between Mrs. Thatcher and General Galtieri, that he might have taken a serious step. But I think it would have taken that, really. And again, against that, I've frequently in the last few months described Saddam Hussein as suffering from what I've called the Galtieri syndrome, that when a dictator decides to take a plunge, an aggressive plunge, he finds it quite impossible to get back onto the bank again. And I just don't think that Argentina had any intention of pulling out once they'd made that move. And indeed, published material that's come out since then tends to confirm this. So I don't think I agree with Enrique. I thought that Secretary General actually did a very good job of negotiating. I don't think anybody could have done it more skillfully in a better organized way, building up this draft treaty. I was full of admiration for that. No, I don't think it was predestined. I don't think anything would have changed the situation.
After the landing of the British troops actually took place, the Security Council still asked the Secretary General to endeavor to obtain a ceasefire. And the Secretary General indicated in his response that he thought this was an impossible task, but nonetheless he would try, which he did, in conversations again with you and with the Argentine representatives. It just happens that I still have my notes on one of those conversations. And took a number of the Secretary General's points seemingly quite seriously, and were indicating you were going to report them back to London, a reference to the precedent of the 1973 Sinai negotiations. Was this taken at all seriously? Was there ever really a possibility of a ceasefire?
Well, again, I think, you know, it sounds easy just to turn everything, easy simply to turn everything on to Argentina. But the scenario I was painting to London from the end of the Perez de Cuellar negotiations, that is to say the resumption of the Security Council meeting, was as follows. I was saying Argentina's tactics from now on are going to be to try to mire us down into an endless negotiation of some kind or other, which will gradually sap our will to recover the islands and eventually leave the new status quo, or at least part of it, in place. So they are going to press all they can for ceasefires which are not linked to immediate withdrawal, so that once we've ceased fire, we'll have lost impetus. Then the negotiation will start, and a year later we'll still be negotiating. We must not be drawn into this trap. This is what I was saying. So what we must do is to make clear to the Secretary General, anybody else who wants to listen, that the only circumstances in which we will accept a ceasefire is if it is absolutely, unequivocally, and credibly linked to immediate Argentine withdrawal. We can discuss any number of points around that, but that is the central point which we've got to adhere to. The government, obviously, in Britain felt exactly the same. So I think that really is the answer. I mean, certainly we took all these points seriously. But, I mean, I hope from your notes of long ago that I was unequivocal on this point, that ceasefire and withdrawal must be absolutely inextricably linked.
Yes, that point is always clear. I have a few overall questions with regard to the crisis in the world. One of them is on decision making. This has been gone over with the Argentinian side, and incidentally, just for information, at least Mr. Costa Mendes has indicated that General Galtieri could not take decisions by himself, that it was purely a consensual arrangement, and that he was unable to make decisions, which is interesting. But what about the decision-making process on the British side? How important was the input from you, from the UK mission in New York, in terms of the ultimate positions of the British government?
Well, I thought, and you know, I've lived through many British government crises, in the foreign affairs crises in my life, and I thought it was all handled in a very smooth way. I mean, this war cabinet was set up, which contained all the people needed and nobody who wasn't needed. And quite a large body, but still, everybody there had a part to play. Prime Minister was a very firm chairman, but not a dictatorial one at all. I mean, there's an unlike popular perception. I thought, I mean, perhaps this is rather conceited to say, but I thought our input was important. Thanks to the very good communications, thanks to the fact that I was in personal contact with the Foreign Secretary and with the Prime Minister quite a lot, I felt also the fact that I had a live feed into my office in the House of Commons. I felt that I was pretty well zeroed in, really, on both the political ingredients and the operational ingredients in London, and there wasn't much of their thinking that I wasn't abreast of. That was my own perception of myself, as it were. I can't remember a time when we kind of fell out, when my recommendations were rejected with contempt or totally disagreed with. I mean, there were differences of emphasis here and there. But generally speaking, I mean, considering the volume of correspondence, and on top of that, the number of personal telephone calls, on our side, it all went very smoothly. I mean, I remember before I left New York some months later, weeks later, in July, I decided to write a dispatch on the whole crisis. And I sent for all the papers, going right back to the 1st of April. And they had to be brought in on a trolley. I mean, over 3,000 long telegrams had been exchanged during that period, quite apart from everything else. And yet, at no time did one feel that the whole thing was becoming chaotic, or that there were cross-purposes going on in London. I mean, I know there is a popular idea, you know, the Foreign Office felt this and the Prime Minister felt that, and she was constantly overriding him. Maybe that something like that was happening in London. It certainly didn't penetrate to me. And occasionally one felt there was a difference of emphasis, but only of emphasis. Because I think the remarkable thing in Britain was, really, that politically, unlike on so many other occasions, there was this astonishing unity between all the parties. And there's no doubt about it. I mean, having heard on my live feed the first debate in the House of Commons on the Saturday after the invasion, that any Prime Minister, whoever it had been, who had not sent a task force, would not have been in power 24 hours later.
So you had the advantage of clear instructions, clear communications,
yeah,
and clear understanding.
Yes, yes. And when I was in any doubt at all, I mean, I could telephone. I mean, I knew the Prime Minister well, I knew the Foreign Secretary not so well, all the kind of top people and officials in the Foreign Office were old friends and so on, so there was a complete ease of communication as far as I was concerned.
Now, on the Argentine side, there was some impression that the attitude of the Secretary General changed toward the later stages, especially at the time of his aide memoir of May the 19th, that in their view, that he became less objective, more inclined toward the British side. Did you have any such impression?
I certainly got the impression, I think the only time I felt, I mean, all through the negotiations themselves, I felt that he was absolutely objective. I confess that I felt that the emotions of certain members of his team varied a little in certain respects. As far as he was concerned, I got an impression of total objectivity. I certainly did feel, when I came back on the 17th and delivered the agreement to him, that he was impressed by that, and that he had expected a much more negative response after my return to London. Was really very surprised and favorably impressed by the deal we were offering, in fact. Well, I suppose to that extent, maybe his view did change. He suddenly realized that we weren't quite so hard-nosed as he'd thought.
And a very